Welcome to Local Exposure, a podcast about music and the greater Cincinnati scene. I'm Jim Nolan.
If you're worried about me...
If we've got any surprises for each other, I don't think we're in much shape to do anything about it.
Well, what do we do?
Why don't we just wait here for a little while? See what happens.
Nick Barrows and Jay Reynolds are longtime friends who wanted to collaborate on a most extraordinary project. To develop a soundtrack to a John Carpenter film that doesn't exist. They named the project after the main character in Carpenter's The Thing, played by Kurt Russell. In discussing the band and its music, it's difficult to not begin to rabbit hole into any number of pop culture references from the 80s, including politics, books, and dozens of movies. Musically, however, MacReady UK exists to provide a soundtrack to any number of apocalypses because, as they say, if civilization is going to end, you might as well enjoy the soundtrack. Nick, Jay, thanks for joining me.
No problem.
Where do I begin? Sorry. There's a lot to go into with this band. I guess the question that's first and foremost on my mind is what's going on with all the Kurt Russell references in your life there, Nick?
Well, to say that I'm a fan of both John Carpenter and Kurt Russell is an understatement, to say the least. Yeah, I'm a big fan of Kurt Russell, and I'm a very big fan of John Carpenter. Absolutely.
Because your other band, the Jack Burton Overdrive, obviously a reference
to
Big Trouble in Little China. And now we have MacReady.
Yes, MacReady UK, yes.
And okay, that brings us to the next question. What's the UK? Is there another band called MacReady?
Yeah, so we started this project, I want to say 2 years ago. And our schedules, it took a little longer to finish than we'd anticipated. And in the time, you know, when we first envisioned it, I did a Google search for MacReady band. I didn't see anything. Said, oh, great. You know, this name is not being used by anyone. And then fast forward to, gosh, I guess back September or something, someone messaged me on Facebook and says, hey, we've got this, you know, synthwave project that's a tribute to John Carpenter called MacReady, and so do you. And they'd released something, I think, back in September. So it was... We're sort of going back and forth with them about it. And sort of the solution that we came up with was the one that made it look like sort of like an old school 80s copyright beef, you know, just to kind of go along with the era that we're sort of nodding to anyways. So we became the band from Britain that got kind of hosed out of their name and had to append it with UK just because, you know, that sort of seemed to go with stretch of the 80s where John Carpenter was making movies and scoring his own films and stuff like that.
Which is beautiful because Nick's in Ohio and you're in Texas.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The description that I've seen written about MacReady UK is that it's the soundtrack to any number of apocalypses.
Well, I think it is more of a dystopia. It's kind of in between that. I think it's a universe in my head where it's, you know, it's a kind of a place where they don't have fresh water, but they somehow have gasoline. There's no television going on, but yet somehow they have shortwave radio and walkie-talkies. So it's this kind of slightly to the current situation that we live in a political element. So we thought we could just, the best way to kind of handle that is put a soundtrack to it.
So we're somewhere between Red Dawn and Road Warrior?
Maybe.
And this is, in your mind, this is the soundtrack to that sort of semi-alternate timeline.
I think so. I mean, at least that's what we're really trying to achieve there a little bit.
Yeah, I think when you look at like a narrative, just in the most broad sense, and obviously, you know, film and literature come to mind first, but, you know, songs also have narrative. There's no good story gets told without an antagonist. And then sort of the tenor of your story sort of balancing that tension. And I think what we have here is songs with very clear sense of there being an antagonist. So somewhere in there, either, you know, with some of the voiceover in there or just what it does melodically or what it does tonally. The bad guy is either there the whole time or shows up or, you know, there's that tension. And we're sort of trying to make a song for the end of civilization. With that in mind, it's obviously stuff's going wrong, but it's also sort of like you don't have a good story if stuff goes right, you know.
You spoke of the voiceover bits on the album. Who is that voiceover actor?
Wendy Slayton, she's here in Austin, Texas. She's actually like a singer-songwriter and is a professional actress. We were trying to, again, with the idea of narratives and that we're sort of created these soundtracks for John Carpenter movies that don't exist. I wanted to add something to it that sort of pulls from like a cinematic feel and has like, you know, a character and also just like a human voice in there somewhere because everything else is drum machine and synthesizer. And so we kind of came up with these short little scripts that could potentially be something someone in a John Carpenter movie says and had her come in and read it. And it was interesting because what we wound up performance-wise, I kept having to tell her to like read it like you're bored, read it like this. These concepts that are very high concept and, you know, kind of speculative fiction oriented stuff, like read it like it's the most boring thing you've ever thought of, you know, that we're talking about interstellar travel and alien species or what have you, but like read it like this is dumb. And it just to kind of give it almost like a punk rock, like the in some 80s movies, it would be the chick with the mohawk who's popping her gum and rolling her eyes at all the aliens and monsters and undead creatures. And just kind of wanted to create that character with her.
Well, it's really interesting because what happens then with that sort of I don't care tone to her voice, it almost lends it this edge of being AI generated as well.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I think when you have this kind of almost all these scenarios that seem to be kind of menacing and something bad is approaching and then you have this kind of, okay, whatever kind of dialogue going through there. I think sometimes that brings in a little bit of the how humanity sometimes kind of shuts down a little bit with a dismissiveness of what can be coming on the horizon a little bit on a sonic scale and also kind of on an emotional scale.
Before we get too much further into this conversation, I want to let people get a listen to the music of MacReady UK. I want to play a track from this new release. This is called Alamo.
It's completely mind-boggling. Millions of years of evolution, man and all the wonders of the world.
So, Jay, you made reference to the antagonist in this narrative. Who do you picture as the antagonist? Is it human? Is it superhuman? Is it computer generated? Is it just the big evil corporation? Who is the bad guy?
Well, when I'm saying, you know, a John Carpenter movie that doesn't exist, I actually have sort of a flavor, sort of a general construct in my head. You know, I think we both do. I think anyone who's familiar with, you know, Escape from New York and The Thing and Big Trouble and even like Halloween, kind of once you say those words, it sort of forms up into a set of images and concepts. And I think the one thing, if you look at what John Carpenter is always trying to say thematically, there's always this sort of subversive message within it that, yes, there's all this stuff going on that's supernatural or what have you, but the real tragedy that he's still trying to focus on is a very human tragedy. You know, that it's humanity's struggle with humanity every single time, and then it's always expressed through one character, usually played by Kurt Russell. So to me, it's really a story of an individual personal antagonist doesn't really do anything except for maybe a problem for one person. When you're talking about the end of civilization or the end of the world, you're really talking about everybody as the antagonist at a certain point, and whether that's expressed like in Prince of Darkness, where it's something slowly taking over everybody psychically, or in Mouse of Madness, where just reality just starts to fall apart, it still is the whole world is somehow dysfunctional. And I think in this case, we're looking at the whole world, especially with what, as Nick referenced earlier, with our current, you know, political climate in America, it's really, it's like sort of the horror of it is like our whole civilization as its own antagonist, which I think is something that fits into that larger framework of, you know, genre fiction and apocalypse and, you know, what have you.
It's the snake that eats its own tail.
Yeah.
I can't help but find parallels with this narrative again with Stephen King. I'm thinking of The Stand, Dark Tower, those epic books that he put together around the same period of time as the John Carpenter films, and also with this character that evolves and changes and morphs from book to book, but is always pervasive and sort of humanly embodies this is what evil is. Was any of that in your consciousness when this was going on too?
Yeah, a little bit, actually. Maybe not to the point of like conjuring up Stephen King or his stories, but I think what you can take from, especially during that time frame between that and Stephen King and Carpenter, when they were dealing with kind of an apocalypse or a dystopia or something is changing into what could it, like that on the horizon. And that was kind of a lot of the focus on these songs. It's never in the middle of it. You know, it's almost a metamorphosis that is kind of slowly going on as we kind of approach and begin. So a lot of this is kind of like an alpha element, not necessarily getting to the not at the omega. So it's just kind of this transition that is going on. So that's kind of what was in my head. And of course, you know, having these backdrops of just all these influences kind of coming in on that definitely laid the groundwork to kind of approach it and have this journey, so to speak, and transition kind of begin.
So many images are coming through my head the more we talk. Because Nick, you and I are about the same age, and I assume that Jay is probably in that same area. As you're speaking, I'm thinking of the movie Beneath the Planet of the Apes.
Yes.
Because we all grew up in the 80s. We all grew up during the peak of the Cold War.
Yes.
And
yes,
this shadow of our own assured mutual destruction, I think was the phrase that was hammered in time,
yes,
and time again.
Yes.
Growing up in that era is growing up under a huge shadow. Do you feel that it affects not only your music, because you're also a writer? Does it affect your writing? Does it affect other parts of your life?
I think so. I think if you kind of step back in being our age and remembering that there was this bigger picture of fear with, at any moment, there could be just this annihilation in the blink of an eye.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think that when you deal with that for X amount of years, that I think that just, I guess even subconsciously, just kind of stays with you.
And another trope of the movies of that time, I'm thinking of War Games and Manhattan Project, is just how fragile that guard is, that it just takes one small mistake or misunderstanding to trigger cataclysm.
And I think tapping into that kind of, you know, a teenager with an old pup, Tab Pulloff can somehow undermine and take down the government and create chaos. I think that there's something humorous, but also very scary in that. And I think that's kind of that's always stuck with me as well.
You're flooding my brain. Now I'm thinking of Trek 182.
Sorry.
Oh, wow. It's the only thing that has 182 at the end of it that you want to mess with. Let me just.
If you don't mind, I want to take a few steps back and talk about, how did you guys meet and how did you decide to collaborate and form this band?
Let's do this in two parts. I'll start and then Jay, you start. We actually have known each other for a long time. Back sometime in the 90s, we lived in Clifton Heights. Is that Clifton Heights right there? Coy Street. And we all lived in the same house. And I'll let Jay kind of take this over from here, because there's a lot of ins and outs, but it's a lot going on there. But we've known each other for a long time.
Yeah, I think we wound up roommates because we were both some mutual friends. In particular, I think we had Matt Hart and Eric Appleby, who were Matt was from Squirt Gun, and those guys went on to form Clifford Never Knew, and they do Matt. Most of those Matt's obviously really super involved in like poetry and literature and stuff like that now. And Eric and his wife, Trisha, do that Forklift Ohio compilation, a Journal of Light Industrial Safety and Cooking, I think is how they describe it. So it's funny because like our initial connection was through these people who were, you know, doing poetry readings and stuff like that. And I think at one point I played some like really weird avant-garde, like trying to sound like John Coltrane saxophone behind Matt Hart at some point. I don't know. It's interesting that, you know, at some point the gears all switch because Nick writes and reads. I don't write and read poetry. It's not something I do. But I go to reading sometimes, especially, you know, with friends I've got. So we wound up in the same house and, you know, fast forward, both play music and are fans of it, you know, just separately from our initial connection. And then, you know, we've been really close friends for years. And fast forward to, gosh, what was it, 2 years ago? And I just started getting back into using hardware synthesizers. I've been using software for a long, long time. I just got my Mini Moog refurbished by a shop down here in Austin called Switched On, and had bought some other stuff. And Nick had just done some sketches in GarageBand. I was like, oh man, I really like the opportunity to use this hardware on something. And here are these ideas. And so we just sort of started fleshing out those sketches into eventually what became the EP.
How did you end up in Austin?
I was basically making a living as a freelance audio engineer in Cincinnati. I had a couple like almost steady things. I was doing sound design for Children's Theater Cincinnati. I was subbing for Nick Rodina over at the 20th Century as like the house tech. And then I just pick up like out of PA that I could get, and I would pick up gigs. And then a guy named PJ Harrington, who used to book the Mad Frog and was in the band Evan Walker, like a reggae band around town, had moved down to Austin, gosh, I want to say 2005-ish. He would call me or text me every once in a while with technical questions, and I'd answer his questions. And he calls me one day, and he says, hey man, you know, asked me, like, do you know this particular Yamaha digital console? And I was like, yeah, I just got done doing a show on one. And he's like, hey man, do you want a job? And so it was this opportunity to just kind of, it's a good gig, and it was really an opportunity to just relocate to Austin. And so my wife and I just took it, and, you know, it's been working out okay.
I find it really funny because I know that you have worked previously with bands like Freak Bass and the Cliftones, and Nick, I know your previous work with, like we mentioned, the Jack Burton Overdrive, but then you also work your previous work with Jet Lab. With the exception of maybe Jet Lab, the sound of MacReady UK is nothing like the sound of the bands that you've worked with previously.
Right. And again, this was also when, as Jay said, started getting back into jumping from software into hardware, I was kind of a little bit behind him because I had been in JetLab working a little bit with synth work and so forth. And it really, I got excited about that a little bit because it was a new avenue for me. I mean, it was something I never had kind of really explored at all. So I kind of, we would go back and forth and he, you know, we would talk a little bit about just different synthesizers and stuff like that. And again, at the time, extremely novice about certain things about that. So it just piqued my interest and I started getting very excited about it. So I have a little bit of gear, but it's by no means is what Jay has in Austin and so forth. He has a wonderful, wonderful equipment and gear and stuff like that. So I just have, you know, I have a Korg Mini Lug that I just got about a year or so ago. So I'm even just now just kind of getting into its capabilities in that. But when I started these sketches, it was just at the time software was kind of more practical for me just because it allowed me to kind of walk through the process a little easier. And so it made me feel a little safer, if that makes sense. So I could kind of do this and that rather easily. And then when passing it on to Jay kind of basically had, you know, the notes and he had the skeleton of it and the bare bones of it. And then he could just kind of completely explore what he wanted to do in that. I'm kind of a little bit behind with him on his trail about how he's been approaching gear, but it's been very awesome and fantastic and a great experience.
What's the process of your collaboration? Do you email files back and forth? You share them somewhere that you can work on mutually?
So in this case, you know, Nick would have basically a GarageBand file. And one of the cool features of sort of the Apple software ecosystem, especially for music, is, you know, GarageBand's really ubiquitous and really quick. It's easy for people to get from zero to a song pretty quickly without having to bog down in like the details. You can then take those projects and open them up in Logic, which is Apple's sort of flagship DAW. You'll find that software in commercial studios and big recording rooms, et cetera. Nick would send me the GarageBand file, and then I would open up Logic, and then just basically sort of kick off a sonic jihad against, you know, any of the software stuff. Just wipe it out, just get it out of there. And it sort of started out as an exercise in a lot of cases because the nice thing about software is it'll literally do whatever you want it to. You're like, hey, I want this sort of subtractive synthesis sound where the filters are removing information from the oscillators. Cool, it'll do that. Here's the presets. Here's a whole bunch of presets to do that. Hey, I want additive synthesis. We're starting with a simple waveform and combining another waveform to add harmonic density to it. Great, well, here's this. Well, I've got some synths, but I by no means have an extensive collection of everything. So I don't necessarily just go into the Logic preset, look at it, and be like, oh, here's what this is doing. I'll just get this hardware that does exactly the same thing. It's like there's cases, well, there's this pulse width modulation going on in the square wave, and I don't have a keyboard that will do that or won't do it with the right other features to make this work. So there was a bunch of cases where I was like, oh, I'll just emulate this or I would depart from it. But there were some where it's like, I'm going to have to find out a way to tape three cats together and, you know, get a pony out of it, you know? And so that became the part that was like really fun. I mean, the whole thing, the reason that to me, like getting back into hardware is that you're actually performing with it. Whereas on the computer, it never really, no matter how many controllers assigned, you don't feel like you're really in the moment with it. You're just kind of telling it to render again with all the automation you just threw in, and it sort of chunks along and spits out a stereo file. Well, with, you know, this stuff, it's like, okay, I'm going to go through and I'm going to twist some knobs and do some things intentionally during the performance. And sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes you bump the wrong thing and it does something really super cool that you never would have done intentionally. And it's just, there's a sort of a little more of emotional tenor to that versus just sort of drawing curves on the screen with a mouse, which is like, you just tend to do it and then go back and listen and that's not quite right. So I'm going to move it again. Where with the hardware, you're like, I'm going to do a whole pass and I'm going to decide whether I like it or not. And if I don't like it, I'm going to go redo it. And eventually you kind of get, instead of exactly where you wanted to go, you get somewhere else that's just as good, but it wasn't intentional. It really became a big exercise in that, of having these very intentional sketches and then sort of kind of letting them go off the rails during performance into something completely different.
That sounds like a really interesting blend of the digital ones and zeros and sort of a jazz improv.
Exactly. When Jay is in working with that, I know this sounds weird, but it brings a life to it. It does bring in a little bit of the human element in there. And that's the thing that kind of gets the wonderful surprises that can happen.
Now, earlier we listened to a song called Alamo, and I did want to ask you about the titles of the songs. There's five songs on this EP. All of them have very short titles. Are they intended to be a narrative?
Yes, sort of. If you look at the structure on it, and when I started them, I basically went through the alphabet. So I started with A, and then B, and then C, and then D. And Alamo originally was going to be called Apache for Fort Apache of the Bronx. But there's already really a wonderful, great song called Apache, and I did not want to get anywhere near that. So I used Alamo, which kind of has that same representation. And then something like Childs, which is a character that is in the 1982 version of The Thing, John Carpenter's The Thing. So yeah, there's somewhat of a narrative in there. But when I started this exercise, so to speak, or these sketches, it did just start alphabetically and then kind of went from there.
Are there plans to continue the alphabet?
That's the goal. Yeah. That's, as they say, the dream.
It's going to be the Sue Grafton of Technopop.
Yes, thank you for giving voice to that, because you're just like teetering on the precipice of actually having a concept. You've given it life with that.
Absolutely.
You're welcome. My next question is that, the obvious one. Jay, you're in Texas. Nick, you're here in Ohio. Does that preclude any chance of any live performance or production in front of an audience of MacReady UK?
You know, it's tough. Just as far as, like, to me, what makes, like, compelling performance, I'm not convinced that two guys with a bunch of keyboards and drum machines plugged into stuff is necessarily enough. The songs demand that they be redone in that environment, where to me, like, watching, listening to them, you're kind of forced to watch the movie that your mind creates. You know, again, you've got the soundtrack, your brain supplies the John Carpenter movie. So I think if we did do something, it would be in conjunction with a pretty heavy visual element. So it's not just two guys with keyboards and drum machines kind of plunking around on stage, because, again, that's not terribly compelling. And also, we only have five songs. So I don't know. It's like hauling every single vintage piece of gear I've got out to a venue for 20 minutes. It's maybe something we should revisit after we get the first LP in the bag.
Now, I could envision a project where you guys actually, very much in a Dark Side of the Moon, Wizard of Oz kind of way, where you actually have the sound sync up to the film of The Thing.
Oh, wow. Like, intentionally, like, cut it that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would like that a lot.
I know you would.
That's a lot to get through first. I mean, that's definitely like a double album at that point, right?
Yes.
Or I would be tempted to literally use this as sort of like an aleatoric element, figure out which one of John Carpenter's movies is the shortest, and do that one, regardless of whatever it is. Just like, oh, it's Ghost of Mars. Okay, too bad, we're doing it. Mm-hmm. You know, like, not to say anything bad about Ice Cube or Ghost of Mars, but, you know, probably not my favorite.
But at least with The Thing, you have those wonderful lines from Wilford Brimley.
He is fantastic in that movie.
Yes, he is.
He is so great in that movie.
Nick and Jay, I really want to express my appreciation for you guys coming together and speaking with me today. Like I said earlier, we played one song off the album. We played Alamo. I want to ask you two to collaborate and pick another track off the EP to play as we leave.
I would say Childs.
Yeah, Childs.
Why would you pick that, and what's the song about? You said it's a character reference.
Yes, it's character, and it kind of represents that theme of alienation that happens, and almost to a point of paranoia a little bit. And I think that's kind of what the main theme and the emotion that's trying to be conveyed in that, but just in a very unique way. But especially that character, in that there's a lot of just, you can see the fear kind of paralyzing someone while they're worried about who is the bad person, what is the evil, that's the heart of it, so to speak.
Well, I mean, considering that, and I haven't looked recently, but I would be willing to bet that somewhere in the range of like the high 30s, 38% of Americans still support this current administration. Like, an interesting question to ask yourself is, have these people been taken over by aliens? Or, you know, again, it's getting back to that ourselves as our own antagonist. You know, it's like, okay, who are these people? And what's more, you know, what are they really? Who's the enemy really? And are we our own enemy? How do you tell? You know, and again, getting to this thing of that sense of paranoia. It's like, after a certain point, you can't tell if the person you're talking to is a human or an alien who's about to try and rob you of your identity. The other thing to me in that one, it's one of the ones that some of the sonic qualities dovetail really nicely, especially if, you know, the whole thing with the thing is the question of whether Childs is a thing or not is a cliffhanger. He never resolves that. And then sort of in the last couple of years, stuff's come out where it's like, hey, if you look at the way the lighting's done and the way they light Keith David's eyes in the final scene, it kind of tips you off that he is. So there's a melody that kind of goes throughout the whole song. And at the end, it gets really screwed up and kind of almost like frequency modulated into something that doesn't sound musical anymore. And so I kind of felt like we baked sort of this reveal into the song that's not necessarily in the film, where it's like, is this little innocent sounding normal thing actually something that's going to destroy you? And it's sort of, that's one of the songs where that idea is actually foregrounded in the sonic of some of the elements.
And also, sorry for any spoilers if anyone's never seen the 1982 version of The Thing.
Yeah, sorry.
It's been quite some time.
At that point,
if they haven't
seen
it by now,
probably,
then they deserve it.
And also, like, they've survived this whole thing of, like, us referencing John Carpenter, and clearly they haven't. You know, if all of you out there who just got the thing spoiled, it's good on multiple watches. Go ahead and watch it.
Yeah, it's not The Sixth Sense.
Yeah, right?
Nick Barrows, Jay Reynolds, thank you very much for spending time with me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jim. Really appreciate it.
And this is Childs by MacReady UK. Music of MacReady UK is currently available to purchase or to stream at CD Baby, Apple Music, or Spotify. You can find links to more information about MacReady UK at our website. And while you're there, stick around to eavesdrop on interviews with Derek Trucks, Heavy Hinges, John Curley, and catch up on the latest local music events with our weekly Music Notes feature. All of that and more can be found at wvxu.org/lx. Local Exposure is a production of Cincinnati Public Radio and 91.7 WVXU. Today's episode was recorded by Josh Elstro and produced by me, Jim Nolan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Knowing who your real friends are, that's not hard on a personal level. Who's got your back in a bar fight? Etc., etc. as a species, knowing who your friends are ain't so easy.
Until next time.